Ooh, spooky, scary skeletons. The music was supposed to start way faster. This is already a nightmare.
I'm looking down the hole, you're looking up at me. You're cold and tired, that is easy to see. Lower the rope to you, a bucket on the line. Your membrane will be soft and smooth, and your heart will be mine. It rubs the lotion on its skin, or as it gets the hose again. It rubs the lotion on its skin, precious, it gets the hose.
Hey everybody, welcome to this special episode. This is special for so many reasons. It is Halloween, and it's also our 250th episode. So that's a special occasion, if I've ever heard of one. So the past few years on Halloween, what we've done is to go through, you know, some Halloween-related questions. But frankly, the Halloween questions are dumb. Sometimes. Maybe by next year they'll be great again. So let's not eliminate that possibility. But this year, I decided we would do something a little different. And what I've done is come up with a collection of horrifying entries into the Book of Demonology, also known as Wikipedia. Okay? So we're going to go through some of these columns, articles, pieces of writing, written by the wonderful people of the internet. And I think it's going to be pretty spooktacular, if I do say so myself. So what I did is I kind of looked up some scary ones, but I didn't read them all the way through. You know what I'm saying? I looked them up just enough to see if they're really scary. And these ones were scary, or, you know, sometimes they weren't scary. Let's be honest. Sometimes they were just kind of fucked up. And that'll do it for me. So without further ado, let's get started. I'm going to just pick one from my list here. There's one called Coffin Birth here. So let's just start off with a bang. I'm typing the word Wikipedia.org. It's a .org, by the way, just in case you didn't know. Coffin Birth. So here we go. Coffin Birth. Coffin Birth, known in academia by the more accurate term post-mortem fetal extrusion, is the expulsion of a non-viable fetus through the vaginal opening of the decomposing body of a deceased pregnant woman as a result of the increasing pressure of intra-abdominal gases. This kind of post-mortem delivery occurs very rarely during the decomposition of a body. The practice of chemical preservation, whereby chemical preservatives and disinfectant solutions are pumped into a body to replace natural fluids, have made the occurrence of coffin birth so rare that the topic is rarely mentioned in international medical discourse. You know, only every 100 or so times you're talking with a guy from France, is he like, hey, is it coffin birth? Typically during the decomposition of a human body, naturally occurring bacteria in the organs of the abdominal cavity generate gases as byproducts of metabolism, which causes the body to swell. In some cases, the confined pressure of the gases can squeeze the uterus, or womb, even forcing it downward, and it may turn inside out and be forced out of the body through the vaginal opening, a process called prolapse. Hey, are you a lapse? Are you a prolapse? If a fetus is contained within the uterus, it could therefore be expelled from the mother's body through the vaginal opening when the uterus turns inside out, in a process that, to outward appearances, mimics childbirth. Yes, the miracle of birth. Except everyone's dead, and it's done by horrible dead gases, and probably smells in a way that's not even something that could make sense. The mother's contractions in live birth, the mother's contractions encourage the infant to emerge from the womb. In the case of coffin birth, built-up gas pressure within the putrefied body of a pregnant woman pushes the dead fetus from the body of the mother. Cases have been recorded by medical authorities since the 16th century, though some archaeological cases provide evidence for its occurrence in many periods of human history. While cases of post-mortem fetal expulsion have always been rare, the phenomenon has been recorded under disparate circumstances and occasionally seen in a modern forensic context when the body of a pregnant woman lies undisturbed and undiscovered for some time following the death. This is pretty crazy. Let's see. Let's look at the history. Oh, there's one in 2008? In 2008, the body of a 38-year-old woman, 7 months pregnant, was discovered in an open field 4 days after she disappeared from a residence in Panama. A plastic bag had been left over her head and she'd been gagged. The case was ruled a homicide. No fucking shit. The body had suffered from tropical heat and high humidity and was bloated and highly discolored. At autopsy, the remains of the fetus were discovered in the woman's undergarments. Although the fetus was in a similar state of decomposition, the umbilical cord was intact and still attached to the placenta inside the uterus. Gross, huh? Ghost baby. Ghost mom. That's pretty great. That is a strong start. That is a strong start to this tale of spooktacular Spooksvilles. Happy Halloween. Let's move on to June and Jennifer Gibbons. Comes up pretty quick when you start typing it in. Let's see. June and Jennifer Gibbons, born April 11th, 1963. Jennifer died March 1993, were identical twins who grew up in Wales. They became known as the Silent Twins, since they only communicated with each other. They began writing works of fiction, but turned to crime in a bid for recognition. Both women were committed to Broadmoor Hospital, where they were held for 14 years. June and Jennifer were the daughters of Caribbean immigrants Gloria and Aubrey Gibbons. I'm not sure which one of these... Oh, Gloria's a housewife. I guess that's the mom. So there's a man named Aubrey. Well, we all know why this went wrong. They moved... The twin sisters were inseparable, and their particular high-speed patois made it difficult for people outside their immediate family to understand them. As the only black children in the community, they were ostracized at school. This proved traumatic for the twins, eventually causing their school administrators to dismiss them early each day so they could avoid bullying. Their language became even more idiosyncratic at this time. Soon, it was unintelligible to others. Eventually, the twins spoke to no one except each other and their younger sister, Rose. When the twins turned 14, a succession of therapists tried unsuccessfully to get them to communicate with others. They were sent to separate boarding schools in an attempt to break their isolation, but their pair became catatonic and entirely withdrawn when parted. Let's see. When they were reunited, the two spent a couple years isolating themselves in their bedroom, engaged in elaborate play with dolls. They created many plays and stories in a sort of soap opera style, reading some of them aloud on tape as gifts for their sister. This is so funny because, like, the things that are like, oh, that's really nice, you know, when you're like, oh, if, you know, Olena Dunham grew up making plays with her dolls, but then it's like, no, these two twins who were really creepy made these dolls and tapes for their sister. Inspired by a pair of gift diaries at Christmas 1979, they began their writing careers. They sent away for a mail-order course in creative writing, and each wrote several novels, set primarily in the United States and particularly in Malibu, California, an excitingly exotic locale to romantic girls trapped in a sleepy Welsh town. The stories involve young men and women who exhibit strange and often criminal behavior. In June's book, Pepsi Cola Addict, the high school hero was seduced by a teacher, then sent away to a reformatory where a homosexual guard makes a play for him. In Jennifer's novel, The Pugilist, a physician is so eager to save his child's life that he kills the family dog to obtain its heart for a transplant. The dog's spirit lives on in the child and ultimately has its revenge against the father. Jennifer also wrote Discomania, the story of a young woman who discovers that the atmosphere of a local disco incites patrons to insane violence. She followed up with The Taxi Driver's Son, a radio play called Postman and Postwoman, and several short stories. They wrote in a unique personal style, often with unwittingly amusing word choices. Let's see, they were self-published, da-da-da-da. And let's just move on down to Jennifer's death. You know, I was talking about that story where the dog heart goes in the person. I would like to do a haunted terror story where here's what happens. It's like a kid and, you know, it's like, ooh, so he needs a heart transplant and they decide to get it from a cat. Because, you know, they always get like someone who's a murderer and then they see the murders. So they're like, well, they got it from a cat. And then they put the cat's heart in the kid. And then the story just kind of derails. And it's like, listen, I was going to go through all this stuff that made you be like, oh my God, is he turning into a cat? But basically the kid was just a dick after that. I mean, he was fine, but he was just kind of like aloof. The end. Jennifer's death. According to Wallace, the girls had a long agreement that if one died, the other must begin to speak and live a normal life. During their stay in the hospital, they began to believe that it was necessary for one twin to die, and after much discussion, Jennifer agreed to be the sacrifice. In March 1993, the twins were transferred from Broadmoor to the more open Caswell Clinic in Brigand, Wales. On arrival, Jennifer could not be roused. She was taken to the hospital where she died soon after of acute myocarditis, a sudden inflammation of the heart. There is no evidence of drugs or poison in her system, and her death remains a mystery. On a visit a few days later, Wallace recounted that June was in a strange mood. She said, "I'm free at last, liberated, and at last Jennifer has given up her life for me." After Jennifer's death, June gave interviews with Harper's Bazaar and The Guardian. And by 2008, she was living quietly and independently near her parents in West Wales. She's no longer filed by psychiatry services. Accepted by her community, she seeks to put the past behind her. Dun dun dun! That's pretty creepy. We just kind of both agreed it was time for her to die. Whew. Good one. That's a good one. That is a good one. Let's see. Let's just move on down the list here. We've got a Cicada 3301. Let's see what this is all about. Cicada 3301 is a name given to an enigmatic organization that on three occasions has posted a set of complex puzzles and alternate reality games to recruit highly intelligent individuals from the public. The first internet puzzle started on January 4th, 2012, and it ran approximately 1 month. A second round began 1 year later on January 4th, 2013, and a third round is ongoing following confirmation of a fresh clue posted on Twitter on January 4th, 2014. The stated intent was to recruit intelligent individuals by presenting a series of puzzles which were to be solved, each in order, to find the next. No new puzzles were published on January 4, 2015. The puzzles focus heavily on data security, cryptography, and steganography. That's probably the study of a stegosaurus. There's a haunted cat in here, making it creepy. Hey, creep. It's been called the most elaborate and mysterious puzzle of the internet age and is listed as one of the top five eeriest unsolved mysteries of the internet. And much speculation exists as to its purpose. Many have speculated that it's recruitment for the NSA, CIA, MI6, or cyber mercenary group. Others have claimed it's an alternate reality game, but the fact that no company or individual has taken credit or tried to monetize it, combined with the fact that none who have solved the puzzles have ever come forward, has led most to feel that it is not. Others have claimed it is run by a bank working on cryptocurrency. Dun dun dun! Allegations of illegal activity. Authorities from the Los Andes province of Chile claim that Cicada 3301 is a hacker group and engaged in illegal activities. In July 2015, a group calling themselves 3301 claimed to have hacked Planned Parenthood. However, the group appears to have no connection to Cicada 3301. Damn it. And they said they're not associated with them. Lame. All right. Kind of spooky. I don't know. I'd like to see a corpse. I'd like to see a corpse. That's kind of what we're shooting for, guys. It's Halloween. Okay? Let's see. UVB 76. Not to be confused with UB 40. Okay. Red, red wine. Na, 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 na. UVB 76, also known as the buzzer, is the nickname given by radio listeners to a shortwave radio station that broadcasts on frequency 4,625 kilohertz. It broadcasts a short, monotonous buzz tone, repeating at a rate of approximately 25 tones per minute for 24 hours a day. On very rare occasions, the buzzer signal is interrupted and a voice transmission in Russian takes place. The first reports were made of a station on this frequency in 1982. Its origins have been traced to Russia, and although several theories with varying degrees of plausibility exist, its actual purpose has never been officially confirmed and remains a source of speculation. That's pretty weird. Just some Russian person doing that shit? Let's see. Okay. I have a Russian spy number station UVB 76 active again. Let's play it and see what it sounds like, huh? Do we have to watch an ad for, like, Pert Plus first? Looks like we might. We're watching an ad. It says Armin Van Buuren. Five times number... This is an ad for a DJ. This is good. I can't believe that people are like, who's going to do this? Oh, is Armin Van Buuren going to be there? Well, yeah, then I got to go. He's got the best songs in the right order on his laptop. Okay, here we go. I want to hear the Russian, though. That's enough of that. Here's one that I watched the other day that I actually thought was kind of freaky. So this is a actual event that happened on November 22nd, 1987. I was five. Barely. The Max Headroom broadcast signal intrusion was a television signal hijacking that occurred in Chicago, Illinois, United States, on the evening of November 22nd, 1987. It's an example of what is known as the television business as broadcast signal intrusion. The intruder was successful in interrupting two broadcast television stations within the course of 3 hours. Neither the hijacker nor any known accomplices have ever been found, caught, or identified, which leaves the incident unsolved. The first occurrence took place during the then-independent WGN-TV live telecast of its primetime newscast. Telecast? What the fuck is that? The 9 o'clock news. During highlights from the Bears' 30-10 home victory over the Lions that afternoon in the sports report, the screen went black for 15 seconds, then returned with a person wearing a Max Headroom mask and sunglasses moving around and jumping. His head was in front of a sheet of moving corrugated metal, which imitated the background used for Max Headroom. And then WTTW, Doctor Who was interrupted. So there you go. You can actually watch this thing on the internet. It's on the YouTube. Let's take a look. Max Headroom, WTTW pirating. And so this is the second one, I guess, if they are doing this correctly. And it's translated. Chicago. And the person remains at large, by the way. They never figured out who it was. It was it was distorted, and it was hard to figure out what he was saying. This person tried. So now I'm seeing Doctor Who, which looks very boring, by the way. When people are saying they like Doctor Who, they like old Doctor Who. Okay, so then it said, that does it, he's a freaking nerd. Which I agree with. I would be a suspect if I wasn't, you know, five, because I would probably interrupt Doctor Who. I can turn this up so you can hear it. That does it. He's a freaking nerd. Yeah, I think I'm better than Chuck Swirsky. Freaking liberal. Oh, Jesus. unknown what he's saying. Yeah, it's really freaky looking. Catch the wave. He throws a pill jar. He's screaming and moaning. And he's got this metal thing going around. Your love is fading. I don't know if this is an accurate translation. Comes the theme to Clutch Cargo. I still CBS. Oh, my files. He moans. Oh, I just made a giant masterpiece for all the greatest world newspaper nerds. Moans / screams. My brother is wearing the other one. It's dirty. It's a glove. He puts on a weird glove and then takes it off. And now the mask is just kind of dangling. And there's someone else. Now he's getting his butt hit with a fly swatter. And you can't see the person off screen, and you can't really see him other than his butt. So if you or anyone you know has seen this butt,
as far as I can tell, a massive electric
and then we're back to Doctor Who.
The generator? Are you always so careful?
It's like, and I mean, it's creepy because, like, if you had just seen that, you know, if you'd just been sitting around and then you saw that. Exactly. Wow. The cat wants to go in the closet. Why? I don't know. Let's move on to the article that started this whole thing. I'm going to just call this scafism. Scafism? Scafism. But I might be saying it wrong. But here's what it is. Scafism, also known as the boats, sounds good so far, was an ancient Persian great, cradle of execution, so far so good. Method of execution, not as good. Designed to inflict torturous death that was described by the Persians' arch enemies, the Greeks. The name comes from the Greek word, a bunch of crazy letters, meaning anything scooped or hollowed out. The intended victim was stripped naked and then firmly fastened within the interior space of two narrow rowing boats or hollowed out tree trunks, joined together one on top of the other with the head, hands, and feet protruding. So basically it sounds like you're in sort of a coffin-y thing, right? But your arms and legs stick out. The condemned was forced to ingest milk and honey to the point of developing severe diarrhea, and more honey would be poured on him to attract insects, with special attention devoted to the eyes, ears, mouth, face, genitals, and anus. Don't forget the anus. In some cases, the executioner would mix milk and honey and pour that mixture all over the victim. He would then be left to float on a stagnant pond or be exposed to the sun. The defenseless individual's feces accumulated within the container, attracting more insects which would eat and breed within the victim's exposed flesh, which, pursuant to the interruption of the blood supply by burrowing insects, became increasingly gangrenous. The individual would lie naked, covered from head to toe in milk, honey, and his own feces. The feeding would be repeated each day in some cases to prolong the torture so that fatal dehydration or starvation did not occur. Death, when it eventually occurred, was probably due to a combination of dehydration, starvation, and septic shock. Delirium would typically set in after a few days. In other recorded versions, the insects did not eat the person. Biting and stinging insects such as wasps, which were attracted to the honey on the body, acted as the torture. Let's see, there are a couple historical descriptions. There's a guy named Zonaris who described this in Annals. The Persians outvie all other barbarians in the horrid cruelty of their punishments, employing tortures that are peculiarly terrible and long drawn, namely the boats, and sewing up men in raw hides. But what is meant by boats? I must now explain for the benefit of less well-informed readers. Yes, please. This is like the New Yorker of that time, but it's like, here, I'm going to tell you when they put things in someone's butt. Two boats are joined together, one on top of the other, with holes cut in them in such a way that the victim's head, hands, and feet are left outside. Within these boats, the man to be punished is placed lying on his back, and the boats then nailed together with bolts. Next, they pour a mixture of milk and honey into the wretched man's mouth till he is filled to the point of nausea, smearing his face, feet, and arms with the same mixture, and so leave him exposed to the sun. This is repeated every day, and the effect being that flies, wasps, and bees, attracted by the sweetness, settle on his face and all such parts of him as project outside the boats, and miserably torment and sting the wretched man. Moreover, his belly, distended as it is with milk and honey, throws off liquid excrements, and these putrefying breed swarms of worms, intestinal and of all sorts. Thus, the victim lying in the boats, his flesh rotting away in his own filth and devoured by worms, dies a lingering and horrible death. There's another one, too. Let's see. We'll just keep going. Oh, this one even looks better. The king decreed that Mithridates should be put to death in boats, which execution is after the following manner. Taking two boats framed exactly to fit and answer each other, they lay down in one of them the malefactor that suffers upon his back, then covering it with the other, and so setting them together that the heads, hands, and feet of him are left outside. So far, so good. The rest of his body lies shut up within. They offer him food, and if he refuses to eat, they force him to do it by pricking his eyes. Then, after he has eaten, they drench him with a mixture of milk and honey, pouring it not only into his mouth, but all over his face. They then keep his face continually turned towards the sun, and it becomes completely covered up and hidden by the multitude of flies that settle on it. And as within the boats, he does what those that eat and drink must needs do. Creeping things and vermin spring out of the corruption and rottenness of the excrement, and these entering into the bowels of him, his body is consumed. When the man is manifestly dead, the uppermost boat being taken off, they find his flesh devoured, and swarms of such noisome creatures preying upon and, as it were, growing to his inwards. In this way, Mithridates, after suffering for 17 days, at last expired. I have a question. So you're like, we're giving him the boats. So we're going to put him in there, his head, arms, and legs coming out, and then his, everything else is going to be in this sort of diarrhea coffin. Do you need to open it when he's dead? I would be like, who do they want that boat back? Are they like, well, I could probably still use that boat. Like if someone filled a boat I had, if I had like a nice little boat and someone filled it with diarrhea until they died, I'd be like, you know what? I'm gonna go get a new boat. I am going to get a different little boat. I don't need this boat so badly that I need that. And also, what are you confirming at that point? Is there, like, that seems a little crazy, right? Let's see. What do we have next? Another form of torture, you say? Sounds wonderful. Let's see. This is called Ling Chi. Translated variously as death by a thousand cuts or the slow process. That's what they call my marriage, huh? The lingering death or slow slicing was a form of torture and execution used in China from roughly AD 900 until it was banned in 1905. So only 1,000 years that this happened. That's not so bad, right? In this form of execution, a knife was used to methodically remove portions of the body over an extended period of time, eventually resulting in death. The term Ling Chi is derived from a classical description of ascending a mountain slowly. Ling Chi was reserved for crimes viewed as especially severe, such as treason or killing one's parents. The process involved tying the condemned prisoner to a wooden frame, usually in a public place. If you're going to do this, you might as well watch. The flesh was then cut from the body in multiple slices in a process that was not specified in detail in Chinese law, and therefore most likely varied. In later times, opium was sometimes administered either as an act of mercy or as a way of preventing fainting. The punishment worked on three levels, as a form of public humiliation, as a slow and lingering death, and as punishment after death. According to the Confucian principle of filial piety, to alter one's body or to cut the body are considered unfilial practices. Ling Chi therefore contravenes the demands of Zhao. In addition, to be cut to pieces meant that the body of the victim would not be whole in a spiritual life after death. Oh, that would suck. Let's see. Do they say? It's difficult to obtain accurate details, but they generally consisted of cuts to the arms, legs, and chest leading to amputation of limbs, followed by decapitation or a stab to the heart. Good. That sounds fun. Well, they only did this for about 1,000 years, so that doesn't seem so bad. Photographs. Oh, there's some photographs. Okay, that sounds gross. There's a cat being cut to pieces by her freedom to not leave the room. Let's see what else we've got. Oh, this is a quick one. Eva Dugan was a convicted murderer whose execution by hanging at the state prison in Florence, Arizona, resulted in her decapitation and influenced the state of Arizona to replace hanging with a lethal gas chamber as a method of execution. She was convicted of auto theft. But a bunch of stuff happened. The police discovered she had a father in California and a daughter in New York. She'd been married 5 times and all her husbands had disappeared. I feel like it would be so easy to disappear people in, like, 1890. I mean, I feel like there are places, you know, when you drive into Utah and shit, you just put a body off the road. But now, good God. Good God. Okay, let's just skip down to this. Dugan gave interviews to the press. This is imprisonment and execution, by the way. Dugan gave interviews to the press for $1 each and sold embroidered handkerchiefs she knitted while in prison to pay for her own coffin. She also made for her hanging silk a beaded jazz dress, but later relented and wore a cheap dress as she was worried that her silk wrapper might get mussed. She remained upbeat, so much so that Time magazine called her Cheerful Eva in a story about her execution. The day before the hanging, there were rumors she planned to kill herself before being hanged, and her cell was searched and a bottle of raw ammonia and 3 razor blades hidden in a dress were confiscated. Seems possible then. Dugan's appeal for clemency on the grounds of mental illness was denied, and she was taken to the gallows at 5 a.m. on the morning of February 21, 1930. She was the first woman to be executed by the state of Arizona, and it was the first execution in Arizona history in which women were permitted as witnesses. Well, you know what? You go get yours, girlfriend. Watch that execution. Aside from Dugan, there were 5 women in the death chamber. According to a newspaper account, Dugan was composed as she mounted the gallows. She told the guards, "Don't hold my arm so tight, the people will think I'm afraid." She swayed slightly when the noose was put around her neck and shook her head negative when asked if she had any final words. The trap was sprung at 5:11, and at the end of the drop, the snap of the rope decapitated her, sending her head rolling to a stop at the feet of the spectators. The grisly scene caused 5 witnesses, 2 women and 3 men, to faint. With the replacement of the gallows by the gas chamber in 1934, Dugan has the distinction of being the only woman to be executed by hanging in Arizona. And what a hanging, huh? Goo. 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 That's a good one. Head just popped right off, huh? Well, let's see. This is Joyce Vincent. So here we go. Let's just move down to death, okay? She died in 2003, so she was about 38. Vincent died of unknown causes around December 2003. She was an asthma sufferer, and an asthma attack or complications surrounding her recent peptic ulcer have been suggested as possible cause of death. Her remains were described as mostly skeletal, according to the pathologist, and she was lying on her back next to a shopping bag surrounded by Christmas presents she had wrapped but never delivered. It is not known to whom the presents were addressed, and the police report regarding the case as been disposed of. She was a British woman whose death went unnoticed for more than 2 years as her corpse lay undiscovered in her London bedsit. She'd cut off all contact with everyone she knew. She resigned from her job 2 years before and moved into a shelter for victims of domestic abuse. She reduced contact with friends and family, and she died, and her remains were discovered about 2 years later. So neighbors assumed the flat was unoccupied, and the odor of decomposing body tissue was attributed to nearby waste bins. The flat's windows did not allow direct sight into the accommodation. Drug addicts frequented the area, which may explain why no one questioned the constant noise from the television. Half of her rent was being automatically paid to Metropolitan Housing Trust by benefits agencies, leading officials to believe she was still alive. However, over 2 years, $2,400 in unpaid rent accrued, and housing officials decided to repossess the property. Her corpse was discovered on 25 January 2006 when the bailiffs broke in. The television and heating were still running due to her bills being continually paid by automatic debit payments and debt forgiveness. The Metropolitan Housing Trust said that due to housing benefits covering the cost of rent for some period after Vincent's death, arrears had not been realized until much later. The Housing Trust said that no concerns were raised by neighbors or visitors at any time during the 2 years between death and discovery of the body. Vincent's body was too badly decomposed to conduct a full postmortem, and she had to be identified from dental records. Police ruled death by natural causes, as there was nothing to suggest foul play. The door was locked, and there was no sign of a break-in. At the time of her death, she had a fiancé, but the police were unable to trace him. Her sisters hired a private detective to look for her and contacted the Salvation Army, but these attempts proved unsuccessful. The detective found the house where Vincent was living, and the family wrote letters to her, but as she was already dead by this time, they received no response. No fucking shit. There you go. That is some pretty crazy stuff. So there you go. You could be dead for a couple years. Couple years before anybody finds you. Let's move on to our next one here. Armin Mueyes? Is this the guy? Ah, this is a great one. Armin, let's call him Muse. Here we go. It's got a pronunciation. Armin Mives is a German man who achieved international notoriety for killing and eating a voluntary victim who he had found via the internet. I like when internet is capitalized in cases like this. You know, the internet. After Mives and the victim jointly attempted to eat the victim's severed penis, Mives killed his victim and proceeded to eat a large amount of his flesh. Because of his acts, Mives is also known as the Rotenburg Cannibal, or der Metzgermeister, the Master Butcher. His main occupation was working as a computer repair technician. That makes sense. Looking for a willing volunteer, Mives posted an advertisement on the website The Cannibal Cafe, a blog site for people with cannibal fetishes. Okay, we are gonna just take the risk that somebody's paying attention to me. Well, now I can't find it. The All is like, wanna see The Cannibal Cafe? Maybe it doesn't exist anymore. I don't know. It's got a long story about this same guy. It's got Yahoo Answers type advice seeking. How would one dispose of a head? That's a good question. I think you just put it in the freezer and see what happens. Still no luck. Still no luck. Where is this cannibal cafe? I want to know. Where's the cannibal cafe? Yahoo Answers. It's underground, someone said. Okay, good one. That helps. I don't think it exists anymore. Cannibalcafe.ca? Is that possible? Here's an old webarchive.org. Let's see. My computer's just going to turn into a demon face. Ah, here's the Cannibal Cafe forum we found. It's got a terrible dripping blood effect and a thing that says, warning, adult, possibly offensive content. It could be. The Cannibal Cafe forum is dedicated to covering a full range of sexual fantasy. Is that what it is? The topics here deal with fantasies involving consenting adults. Spam, off-topic posts, and any posts or thread dealing with or implying the participation of minors or underage persons will be deleted. That is sick. Yeah, if it was like you were eating a kid. Gross. 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 Let's see if we can find anything that looks like, I have a mind of my own, it says. Show some control, don't go there. How about that? This to all that feel the need to contact Terry, don't. You have plenty here to enjoy your fantasies with, so a caution to you. Leave her alone, Gary. There's another thing about Terry. Warning, hands off Terry, don't anyone mess with her. This is just a one-time warning, don't mess with Terry. No one contact her, and no one even think about messing with her. I don't even know who this is. Oh, here's Terry Salisbury. Help. Nikolai, help. Would you kindly email me? This girl is driving me crazy. Who's Terry? Who is Terry? You for dinner. Let's see what this one says. You're lying on my table, steam still coming from your hot prepared female body. Slices of pineapple on your juicy breasts, a red apple in your mouth, and you belly stuffed with vegetables. A carrot is up your vagina, makes sense. And around you, even more vegetables and fruit is lying in the tasty sauce, which also runs in a thin layer all over your golden body. My teeth are watering and my stomach rumble as I try to decide where to sink my teeth into your sweet and gorgeous meat first. Are you the woman on my table? Please send me an email with a detailed description of yourself and your body. Send a pic if possible. Tell me why it is you I'm about to eat. Wow. From the Great Dane, I guess. Ooh, that's a good one. Michael Jackson versus McDonald's. There's a lot of posts by Nikolai. That's boring. That's a Michael Jackson joke. I think we're above that here. Thank you very much. Let's see. Discuss your fantasies. How about that? Clicking and waiting. Oh, there's no page of it. This is on the Wayback Machine, by the way. Being new to this site, I didn't realize my email address would not be shown automatically, so let's try it again. Email me at iamashyguy2002@yahoo.com. I'm shy. I mean, I eat people, but you know, I'm a shy dude. Boiled alive. See link for further explanation. No thanks. This material. Butchering the human carcass for human consumption by Bob Arson. This is a step-by-step guide to break down the human body from a full figure into serviceable choice cuts of meat. As in any field, there are a number of methods to the practice, and you may wish to view this as a set of suggestions rather than concrete rules. You know what? It's kind of an art. I mean, it's really, it's art and craft collide. So, you know, learn the rules, and then break the rules. You'll notice that the carving of the larger or commercial cuts down into smaller specific or retail cuts will be only mentioned in passing and not concentrated upon. Also, the use of human fat and viscera is generally avoided and left only to the most experimental chef. Oh, I've got a delicious amuse-bouche for you. It's a old intestine of a man. These choices, along with... It's still attached to the man. Recipes and serving suggestions are nearly infinite in variety, and we leave them to you. We found these guidelines to be simple and functional. Let's see. Before getting to the main task, it must be mentioned that the complete rendering of the human carcass requires a fairly large amount of time, effort, and space. If the consumer does not wish to go through the ordeal of processing and storing the bulk of the entire animal, an easy alternative is as follows. Simply saw through one or both legs at the points directly below the groin and a few inches above the knee. Once skinned, these portions may be cut into round steaks of the carver's preferred thickness, cut into fillets, deboned for a roast, etc. Meat for several meals is thus readily obtained without the need for gutting and the complexities of preparing the entire form. Now see, that's wasteful. That's just taking the hide off the buffalo right there. I'm gonna kill a guy and then just eat his legs. Come on. Here we go. The human being, also referred throughout history as the long pig and hairless goat, is not generally thought of as a staple food source. That's like the beginning of a cannibal thing that begins since the dawn of time. Observing the anatomy and skeleton, one can see that the animal is neither built nor bred for its meat, and such will not provide nearly as much flesh as a pig or cow. For example, an average 1,000-pound steer breaks down to provide 432 pounds of saleable beef. The large central pelvis and broad shoulder blades also interfere with achieving perfect cuts. There are advantages to this, however, especially due to the fact that the typical specimen will weigh 100 to 200 pounds, easily manipulated by one person with sufficient leverage. Now, here the caution in choosing your meal must be mentioned. It is very important to remember that animals raised for slaughter are kept in tightly controlled environments with their health and diet carefully maintained. Well, this was way before Food Inc. Humans are not. Thus, not only is the meat of each person of varying quality, but people are also subject to an enormous range of diseases, infections, chemical imbalances, and poisonous bad habits, all typically increasing with age. Meat loses its tenderness, becoming tough and stringy. No farm animal is ever allowed to age for 30 years. 6 to 13 months old is a more common slaughtering point. You'll obviously want a youthful but mature, physically fit human in apparently good health. So good to know. A certain amount of fat is desirable as marbling to add juicy, flavorful quality to the meat. We personally prefer firm Caucasian females in their early 20s. These are, quote, ripe, but tastes vary, and it is a very large herd. Whoa. So white, single white females in their early 20s. So one advantage, you know, I know as a lady, it can be tough to age, but one advantage is that this cannibal cookbook is like, you're not the desirable one. So you got something there. The butcher will need a fairly roomy space in which to work, and interior location is suggested. Good one. And a large table for a butcher's block. A central overhead support will need to be chosen or installed ahead of time to hang the carcass from. Large tubs or barrels for blood and waste trimming should be convenient, and a water source close by. Most of the work can be done with a few simple tools: sharp, clean, short, and long-bladed knives, a cleaver or hatchet, and a hacksaw. Body preparation. Acquiring your subject is up to you. For best results in health, freshness is imperative. A living human in captivity is optimal, but not always available. You know, it kind of depends on how much kidnapping you've been doing. When possible, make sure the animal has had no food for 48 hours but plenty of water. This fasting helps flush the system, purging stored toxins and bodily wastes, as well as making bleeding and cleaning easier. Under ideal conditions, the specimen will then be stunned into insensitivity. Sharp, unexpected blows to the head are best, tranquilizers not being recommended as they may taint the flavor of the meat. Yeah, that would be a shame. What a shame. I kidnapped this lady. This white Caucasian in her early 20s. I have her all set to go. Don't feed her anything, so she's done pooping. And then I accidentally screwed it up with tranquilizers. If this is not possible without exciting the animal and causing a struggle, which will pump a greater volume of blood and secretions such as adrenaline throughout the body, a single bullet through the middle of the forehead or back of the skull will suffice. Okay. So that's just like, here's how you can kill a person. Good to know. Once the animal is unconscious or dead, it is ready to be hoisted. The 20-year-old white female. Get the feet up first, then the hands with the head down. This is called Gein configuration. I'm assuming that this is spelled like Ed Gein on purpose. Simple loops for rope may be tied around the hands and feet and attached to a crossbar or overhead beam. Or, by making a cut behind the Achilles tendon, a meat hook may be inserted into each ankle for hanging support. Great! The legs should be spread so the feet are outside the shoulders, with the arms roughly parallel to the legs. This provides access to the pelvis and keeps the arms out of the way in a ready position for removal. It's easiest to work if the feet are slightly above the level of the butcher's head. Yeah, you want to be ergonomic. You want to make sure that you're doing this the right way. Bleeding. Place a large open vessel beneath the animal's head. With a long-bladed knife, start at one corner of the jaw and make a deep ear-to-ear cut through the neck and larynx to the opposite side. This will sever the internal and external carotid arteries, major blood vessels carrying blood from the heart to the head, face, and brain. If the animal is not yet dead, Jesus, this will kill it quickly and allow for the blood to drain in any case. After the initial rush of blood, the stream should be controllable and can be directed into a receptacle. Drainage can be assisted by massaging the extremities down in the direction of the trunk, and by compressing and releasing, pumping, the stomach. A mature specimen will contain almost 6 liters of blood. There's no use for this fluid unless some source is waiting to use it immediately for ritual purposes. If you're eating people on this professional level, you probably know someone. It acts as an emetic in most people if drunk, and it must be mentioned here that because of the eternal possibility of AIDS, it is recommended that for safety's sake, all blood should be considered to be contaminated and disposed of in some fashion. It is not known whether an HIV-infected human's flesh is dangerous even if cooked, but this is another item to consider when choosing a specimen, someone in the low-risk strata. Ugh. Yeah, I guess, you know, that's a tough one to, like, call scientists on, right? Just curious. Let's say I ate a guy, but he had AIDS. You know, get tested. Maybe get your animals tested, as you put it. Beheading. When the bleeding slows, preparation for decapitation can be started. Continue to cut the throat around the entire neck from the jawline to the back of the skull. Once muscle and ligament have been sliced away, the head can be cleanly removed by gripping it on either side and twisting it off. Separation occurring where the spinal cord meets the skull. This is indicative of the method to be used for dividing other bones or joints, in that the meat should generally be cut through first with a knife, and the exposed bone then separated with a saw or cleaver. The merits of keeping the skull as a trophy are debatable for two principal reasons. First, a human skull may call suspicious attention to the new owner. Yeah, I mean, unless you got it around Halloween and then you gotta fucking put it away. Secondly, thorough cleaning is difficult due to the large brain mass, which is hard to remove without opening the skull. The brain is not good to eat. Removing the tongue and eyes, skinning the head, and placing it outside in a wire cage may be effective. What? The cage allows small scavengers such as ants and maggots to cleanse the flesh from the bones while preventing it being carried off by larger scavengers, such as dogs and children. You know, kids just wandering around with your skull. After a sufficient period of time, you may retrieve the skull and boil it in a dilute bleach solution to sterilize it and wash away any remaining tissue. Skinning. After removing the head, wash the rest of the body down. Because there is no major market for human hides, again, particular care in removing the... although, you could take a really funny Far Side picture if you've got a baby polar bear and a human hide. Particular care in removing the skin in a single piece is not necessary and makes the task much easier. The skin is in fact a large organ, and by flaying the carcass, you not only expose the muscular configuration, but also get rid of the hair and the tiny distasteful glands which produce sweat and oil. A short-bladed knife should be used to avoid slicing into muscle and viscera. The skin is composed of two layers, an outer thinner one with a thicker tissue layer below it. When skinning, first score the surface, cutting lightly to be sure of depth and direction. The diagram of the skinning pattern is an example of strip-style skinning, dividing the surface into portions easy to handle. Reflect the skin by lifting up and peeling back with one hand while bringing the knife in as flat to the skin as possible to cut away the connective tissues. The external genitals present only a small obstacle. In the male, the penis and scrotum can be pulled away from the body and severed. In the female, the outer lip skinned as the rest of the body. It is important to leave the anus untouched at this point, and a circle of skin should be left around it. You need not bother skinning the hands and feet, these portions not being worth the effort unless you plan to pickle them or use them in soup. The skin can be disposed of or made into fried rinds. Oh. Boil the strips and peel away the outer layer, then cut into smaller pieces and deep fat fry in boiling oil until puffy and crisp. Dust with garlic salt, paprika, and cayenne pepper. These are your pork rinds, I guess. Gutting. The next major step is the complete evisceration of the carcass. To begin, make a cut from the solar plexus, the point between the breastbone and stomach, almost to the anus. Be very careful not to cut into the intestines, as this will contaminate the surrounding area with bacteria and possibly feces. If this does happen, cleanse thoroughly. A good way to avoid this is to use the knife inside the abdominal wall, blade facing toward you and making cautious progress. Make a cut around the anus, or bung, and tie it off with twine. Yeah, I think we know what the anus is, thanks, at this point. This also prevents contamination, keeping the body from voiding any material left in the body. With a saw, cut through the pubic bone, or H. The lower body is now, I think, taint? Is that what that is? Is now completely open, and you can begin to pull the organ masses out and cut them away from the back wall of the body. Let's see. Blah, blah, blah. Remove the arms. Actual butchering of the carcass is now ready to begin. We are just beginning this wonderful process. Cut it straight into the armpit to the shoulder, remove the arm bone, the humerus from the collarbone, blah blah blah. Cutting this portion away. Human flesh should always be properly cooked before eating. Before removing the limb, this decreases the percentage of usable meat on the arm but allows a larger shoulder strip when excising the shoulder blade. Purely a matter of personal preference. Now you split the body in half. Saw straight through the spine from buttocks to neck. This leaves the muscle fiber encasing the vertebrae on the end of the ribs. The meat here, however, is tightly wrapped about the bone, and we find it more suitable, if used at all, when boiled for soup. People, soup. Quarter the carcass. you will want to divide the side of meat into two further principal portions, the ribs and shoulder, and the half pelvis and leg. In between is the flank or belly, which may be used for fillets or steaks, if thick enough, or even bacon strips if you wish to cut this thinly. Cutting the top quarter. Depending on the development of the breast, you may decide it qualifies as a brisket. A perennial favorite for barbecuing, you may divide into sections of several ribs each and cook them as is. Divide the strip in half for shorter ribs or even carve rib steaks if the muscle mash is sufficient. Cut the lower quarter, that's where most of the meat is, the round steaks, blah blah blah. And that's basically it. An average freezer provides plenty of storage space, or you may even wish to build a simple old-fashioned smokehouse. Just like an outhouse with a stone fire pit instead of a shitter, also with a goddamn corpse in it. Offal and other waste trimmings can be disposed of in a number of ways, burial, animal feed, and puree, and flush being just a few. Bones will dry and become brittle after being baked in an oven and can be pulverized. That I did not know. Oh my god. This is really funny. I want you to just take a second and guess what you think the FAQs are on this website. The cannibal, whatever you call it. Cannibal Cafe. Just, you know, let your mind wander. And here we go. Frequently asked questions. Can I use HTML tags in my posts? Why are there colons in the message section when I try to post a follow-up? Why did my post show up? And where can I get scripts for this program? So there you go. Real quick, let's get back to our friend here. Armin Maves. Looking for a willing volunteer, Maves posted an advertisement on Cannibal Cafe, which we just got through. Maves' post was stated that he was looking for a well-built 18 to 30-year-old to be slaughtered and then consumed. Bernd Jürgen Armando Brandis, an engineer from Berlin, then answered the advertisement. Many other people responded, but backed out. Maves did not bother to force them to do anything against their will. The two made a videotape when they met on 9 March 2001 in Maves' home in the small town of Rottenburg, showcasing Maves amputating Brand's penis and the two men attempting to eat the penis together before Brand's ultimate demise. Brand had insisted that Maves attempted to bite his penis off. This did not work, and ultimately Maves used a knife to remove Brand's penis. Brand apparently tried to eat some of his own penis raw, but could not because it was too tough and, as he put it, chewy. Maves then fried the penis in a pan with salt, pepper, wine, and garlic. He then fried it with some of Brand's fat, but by then it was too burned to be consumed. Aww. He chopped it up in chunks and fed it to his dog. You're trying to eat your own penis, and then this guy fucking burns it? Like, I burned some burgers the other night, and that was bad. I was kind of pissed, because I was like, ugh, I'm still going to eat these, but that's your penis? Your one shot? This is your one shot. One opportunity. According to court officials who saw the video, which has not been made public, that was going to be my next search, Brands may already have been too weakened from the blood loss to eat any of his penis. Maves read a Star Trek book for 3 hours while Brands lay bleeding in the bath. Maves gave him large quantities of alcohol and painkillers, 20 sleeping pills, and a bottle of schnapps, kissed him, and finally killed him in a room that he had built in his house for this purpose, the slaughter room. After stabbing Brands to death in the throat, he hung the body on a meat hook and tore chunks of flesh from it. He tried to grind the bones to use his flour. The incident was recorded on the 2-hour videotape. Maves ate the body over the next 10 months, storing body parts in his freezer under pizza boxes and consuming up to 20 kilograms or 44 pounds of the flesh. According to prosecutors, Maves committed the act for sexual enjoyment. Well, there you go. There you go. I just wanted to point out a couple things in the cultural impact section here. Marilyn Manson identified Maves as inspirational in the titling of his album Eat Me, Drink Me. The second band here we've got is Rammstein, wrote the song Mein Teil, which specifically talks about this case and was hugely controversial when it was released. Well, there you go. That was very cannibal-y, huh? Cannibal Holocaust. I think we did it, guys. Did we? This is a real banner 250th, huh? It's like, look what we did. We talked about babies being shot out by dead gases. We talked about twins who killed each other. We had that cicada thing. That was kind of boring. But then we had diarrhea canoe. So I feel like we got back there. And, you know, a lady whose head popped off. Because you know what? She was the first woman to be executed in Arizona. And God love her. Right? Equal rights. Hashtag not all men. Or not all women. Or yes, all women. You know what? Hashtag you go, girl. How about that? You go, girl, and let your head roll into people's laps. Well, I hope you have a great Halloween. Enjoy. Think about just eating a guy, I guess. That seems like a good thing to think about all Halloween. And, you know, keep an eye out for your next, maybe start using that Tinder. Find your next 44 pounds of... Oof, God, okay, bye.